You're listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast. For I Will Be With You. Daily reflections on recovery from the Bible.
Welcome back to the For I Will Be With You podcast for the 26th week of the year from June 24th to June 30th, covering Leviticus 6:18 to Leviticus 11:3. Leviticus 6:18 says, "Speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the law of the sin offering in the place where the elevation offering is slaughtered, shall the sin offering be slaughtered. Before God, it is most holy." Now, what's going on here is that Aaron, the high priest, is receiving instructions on the specifics of bringing offerings in the tabernacle, which will then be continued in the temple in Jerusalem. So this is sort of a blueprint for right now. The Israelites are in the wilderness with the tabernacle, and when they get to Jerusalem, they'll build the temple and they'll do the same thing there, although the temple is bigger, obviously, but it's the same idea. Now, what the detail here, and obviously we're getting into really the deep detail here about the Israelites' religious practices, but we can learn a lot about recovery from these details. That there is an offering called a sin offering, which is brought by people who've sinned unintentionally, and it's slaughtered in the same place in the temple courtyard as the elevation offering, which is brought for people who have who need to atone for hidden thoughts of the heart. So just a little side note that the temple, the tabernacle courtyard where the different offerings were brought has different locations, and different offerings were brought in different locations in the temple courtyard. So in this case, the detail to take note of is that the sin offering and the elevation offering are brought in the same place, therefore they're considered similar or comparable. So that the Bible is equating the two offerings, even though they're for two different things. So, from our perspective, let's ask the question, what is the similarity between a hidden, sinful thought and a careless, unintentional sin? So, according to some of the commentators, later commentators, we can look at this way. People don't grow careless in a vacuum. Sinful thoughts and desires usually precede the careless act. So we find this in recovery very often. We act out or even relapse seemingly out of nowhere. One day, it seems like we just woke up and walked into a bar for no reason. But there really isn't for no reason. There isn't any out of nowhere. If you think carefully about what's going on, and sometimes you have to work with someone else to figure this out, you can see that the relapse or acting out was preceded by a period of poor thinking, resenting others, feeling angry and not dealing well with it, that kind of thing. The careless acting out or relapse is typically a result of a thought process that we need to become aware of if we are to handle it and maintain our sobriety. Leviticus 9:1 and 9:2 says, "It was on the eighth day Moses summoned Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. He said to Aaron, 'Take yourself a young bull for a sin offering.'" God wanted Aaron to offer a sin offering so he could atone for his role in the incident of the golden calf. So we can learn a number of things from this. For one thing, as we always say in recovery, you have to make amends when you've done something wrong. Aaron was involved in the sin of the golden calf, even if he can be let off the hook for most of it, due to a lot of different explanations of what happened. But the bottom line is he was there, and it happened, and he played a role in it. someone of his stature probably should have been able to do more to avert this kind of spiritual catastrophe. As a result, he needs to bring a sin offering. But thinking it all the way through, the sin offering atones for him and he is now free from sin. This is a very significant idea. God forgives. Once the offering is brought and the amends are made, Aaron is cleansed of the sin. And this is a very deep concept in recovery, which is that we make amends, we say we're sorry, but do we really feel like we've made up for it? And always, it's not that simple. Sometimes it takes a while or takes more work to get yourself over and make amends for something bad if you did it, but you are forgiven. When you are forgiven, you're forgiven. If God can let you off the hook, someone else can let you off the hook too. We need to stop beating ourselves up. If our amends are good enough for God, they ought to be good enough for us. Leviticus 9:7 reads, Moses said to Aaron, come near to the altar and perform the service of your sin offering and your elevation offering and provide atonement for yourself and for the people. Moses is asking Aaron to approach the altar to make his sacrifice because Aaron was apparently afraid to come near the altar. And what I want to explain here is sort of a detail that you need to understand, which is that the altar and the holy spaces of the tabernacle were considered, the holy energy was so powerful that if you misused them or, you know, did something incorrectly, you could actually suffer death as a punishment. That the holiness was so intense that if you didn't know what you were doing or if you weren't sort of in a spiritually correct state of mind, you could actually suffer death as a punishment. So Aaron is afraid to do it. He's afraid to come and make his offering. He was ashamed of himself for his role in the golden calf. But Moses encourages Aaron to approach, saying that he was chosen for this purpose. He was chosen to be the high priest. But fear of approaching holiness is a common emotion for recovering addicts. When we're in the rawness of sobriety, especially early sobriety, the idea of getting close to a higher power, one that might judge us for our past transgressions, can be terrifying. Yet we are encouraged to approach God or seek God, for that is where recovery happens. And one of the commentators actually said that this verse reveals that Aaron was in fact chosen because of this humility. His feeling like he's not worthy is the quality that God wants because God despises haughtiness. In recovery, too, haughtiness can interfere with our conscious contact with God. After all, if we all have all the answers, what good is God to us? Yet, if we look at ourselves honestly, we will know how right we were with all our answers, meaning we weren't right. We needed God's help to understand the truth. So continuing with this verse, it says, the same verse continues, says, Moses says to Aaron, come near the altar, provide atonement for yourself and for the people. The verse then says, then perform the service of the people's offering and provide atonement for them as God directed. So the second half of the verse describes Aaron bringing an offering on behalf of the people for their atonement after he brought his own offering for his own atonement. So it's a little confusing. The verse seems to say that Aaron's own personal offering atoned for the people. So it's a little bit overlapping. It's a little bit confusing. The commentators explain this by saying that Aaron's personal offering did actually atone for the people's sins, but that the people then had their own distinct offering as well. So to look at it from our perspective, if Aaron were an old-timer at a meeting, it would also work this way. His personal recovery on its own would inspire others. He might work directly with others as well to help them recover. Both are helpful and necessary. is his own recovery and working with others for recovery. And his recovery inspires people, and his work with people is directly with them. There's an even deeper way of looking at it, though, which is, according to one of the great commentators, Aaron could only perform an offering for the people to atone after he had atoned himself. This makes sense in its own way. Similarly, in recovery, we can really only help others once we've done the work ourselves. Part of this is basic experience and knowledge. You can't guide someone in step work if you haven't done it yourself. But more importantly, unless you've done the spiritual work of recovery for yourself first, you won't be of much help to anyone else. Now, Leviticus 10:1 and 10:2 introduces a very tragic and perplexing incident in the Torah, which is the death of two of Aaron's sons. The verse reads, "The sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, each took his fire pan. They put fire in them and placed incense upon it, and they brought it before God, an alien fire that he had not commanded them. A fire came forth from before God and consumed them, and they died before God." So what's happened here is that two of Aaron's sons took their fire pans, which were sort of these holy vessels that were used for moving around the fire and incense, and they went into the tabernacle, the holiest space of the tabernacle, without being told to, and performed their own seemingly sort of impromptu, spur-of-the-moment ritual. And somehow this fire came out and burnt them up, or they were killed. There's a lot of interesting discussion about what actually happened, because later on it says that they were carried out in their clothing, which means they weren't actually burned. It might have been more like sort of like electricity or some fire energy that just consumed them, but that they weren't actually burnt up. But it's a very troubling story, and it's very hard to understand. And the truth is, there are no really satisfactory explanations of this. And I think that that alone is important. I think sometimes when you're looking at the Bible, it's tempting to say, oh, I understand what this is all about. Sometimes you're not going to understand what it's all about, and really nobody does. And you'll have a lot of opinions from some extremely smart and learned people, and you still don't really understand. They're just offering interpretations, and maybe that's okay. Sometimes things happen that we don't understand, and I think it's okay to accept that we don't understand them. Certainly a lot of tragic events fall into that category. But one interpretation of this event is that these men violated a strict holy law of the tabernacle by going in and making an incense offering that was not required. You're not allowed to add on to biblical commandments, like create your own extra biblical commandments, and certainly not allowed to go into this holy space without specific reason on instruction from God. So in punishment, they were killed. And remember, as we said before, about Aaron's fear of the altar, that, you know, the holiness, the holy energy was so high in this place that if you misused it, you were risking death. And, you know, if this seems extreme, you have to remember that one of the basic principles of the Torah is that people on a higher spiritual level are expected to act on a higher level. So if someone like you and I made this kind of mistake, we wouldn't get this kind of punishment, because you and I are not on the level of Nadab and Abihu. Now, I shouldn't speak for you, but I'm just speaking for myself. I'm not on the level of Nadab and Abihu. These men were tremendous holy men. They were prophets. They were at a level that's hard for us to understand. So when they made a mistake, it killed them. Another perspective is really the opposite, which is that this act was so spiritually perfect that it fulfilled an entire lifetime of spiritual potential. And that was it. God was like, okay, you've done everything you can possibly do in this life on planet Earth, and I'm going to bring you home to heaven. So which is it? Did they screw up, or was it the ultimate perfection? So we can look at it too for ourselves as a warning and an inspiration. It's always risky to invent your own program and go against established wisdom. you know, trying to channel holy energy in personal, untested ways can be like playing with fire. You can get burned. The people you're trying to help can get burned. Alternatively, you can look at this event as an inspiration to try harder, try to go further. So maybe the balance is where the important stuff happens, that you need to try harder, go further, but stay within the framework that you've been given. Leviticus 10, 8 and 9 reads, God spoke to Aaron, saying, "Do not drink intoxicating wine, you and your sons, when you come to the tent of meeting, that you not die. This is an eternal decree for your generations." So if you're an alcoholic and you're reading this, you might say, yeah, of course, duh. Of course you can't get drunk before you do holy service in the temple. Do you even, you know, need to make a comment like this? But I guess the answer is yes. And that's important to note, that God is speaking directly to Aaron instead of Moses. Almost all the way through the Bible, God speaks to Moses, who then tells everybody else what God has said. But in this case, God is speaking directly to Aaron. And we forget that Aaron also was a big prophet and could hear the word of God. So in this case, this instruction to avoid drinking before doing the holy services is important enough for God to tell it directly to Aaron. One interpretation of this verse is that God is trying to explain to Aaron that his sons were killed before they performed illegitimate worship while drunk. And just one quick note, when in the verse it says, when you come to the tent of meeting, that's another phrase that's used to describe the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. So it's saying you cannot be intoxicated when you enter the tent of meeting. And, you know, this makes sense, that you have to have a clear head when you're doing, the priest has to have a clear head when he does the offerings in the temple. And one of the reasons for this is that intention is very important in Jewish worship or in any kind of holy activity. Your mind has to be focused on the spiritual activity, or it is meaningless. If you're trying to have conscious contact with God and meditate with God, but you're thinking about whether, you know, the Cavaliers are going to win the playoffs, you're not going to really get a lot of conscious contact going. You're going to be wasting your time. And similarly, if you cloud your mind with drink or any substance or activity that interferes with spiritual focus, the outcomes will probably not be what you want. You can also look at this verse as a caution not to involve yourself with drinking activities that may be theoretically allowed on your program, like quote-unquote drinking-type activities, which may interfere with your serenity and conscious contact with God. So, you know, like you're allowed to be angry and resentful, you know, those aren't a violation of your program, but they are going to cloud your program. And of course, playing games with addiction and seeing what you can get away with doesn't really help anybody, especially yourself. So for example, if you're in a program like Gambling Anonymous or something, but your sponsor tells you it's okay for you to drink because you're not an alcoholic, maybe you should be very careful about that, because you might pretty soon become an alcoholic if you're not careful. People often switch addictions when they feel they have a license to act out in ways of, you know, that are not strictly against the rules. Leviticus 11:3 reads, "Everything among the animals that has a split hoof, which is completely separated into double hoofs, and that brings up its cud, that one you may eat." Now, what we have here with the Bible's changed topics now, and is going into some of the laws of kosher food, kosher dietary laws. So as you may know, Jewish people have very extensive and strict dietary laws, and other religious groups do too. And you'll see, you know, at the supermarket, the kosher section or whatever, you might wonder what that's all about. So one of the kosher laws is that you can't eat any different kind of animal. For example, you can't eat a pig. Pig meat is not allowed. You can only eat an animal that has, I'm not talking about birds or fish, any kind of, you know, walking, you know, mammal. You're only allowed to eat animals that chew their cud and have split hooves. So if you look at a cow or a sheep, they actually have two little hoofs, like, whereas a horse is not allowed. A horse only has one hoof. So now this may seem sort of arbitrary and weird, and I know it's a little bit hard to understand. And the reality is that some of the Jewish dietary laws are really arbitrary. And they're arbitrary on purpose, in a sense that they make you contemplate following a law, even if you don't understand it. But one interpretation of this split hoof idea is we should be careful when we think about that which attaches us to the ground. And this is, so the idea here is that it's considered good to have, you know, your feet on the ground, so to speak. But there's another way to look at it, that the ground, or, you know, dirt or nature is the realm of animals, and a human being is not supposed to act like an animal. And in fact, very often when we see someone who's acting in a way that we don't like, we say this person is acting like an animal, meaning greedy, selfish, violent, overdoing it, uncaring. That's animal behavior. Animals don't care about feelings and whatever the way people do. Now, of course, people may argue about that, and I don't want to offend anybody, but generally speaking, animals don't have the kind of, you know, moral system that humans potentially have. So when you're touching the ground, when your feet are on the ground, so to speak, you are entering the realm of animals. So an animal that has a split hoof, so it's standing on two feet, two toes on the ground, is should remind us that we need to be circumspect about how we relate to animal behavior. And, you know, if you think about it, some of our most base appetites, our worst ethical behaviors are natural. Like, it's, of course, you know, it's natural. For example, let's say that you walk into a room of 10 hungry people and there's food on the table. It's totally natural for an animal to eat all of that food without thinking about any of the other animals in the room. That's nature. But humanity is something different. Humanity might make you think, perhaps I should only eat as much as I'm allowed to, or share with others, or not overeat and let everyone else be hungry. That's unnatural behavior. But that's what being a human being is really about. And so this sort of abstract dietary law hints at that suggestion that we be circumspect about that which attaches us to the ground, to the dirt of nature, and that we should rise above our animal instincts and learn to act like human beings. So we, in symbolic terms, by eating animals that don't touch the ground with a single foot, but which have a split hoof, that should remind us to be wary of our connections to pure nature.
You've been listening to the For I Will Be With You podcast, daily reflections on recovery from the Bible. www.foriwillbewithyou.com